Hello and welcome to our latest episode of the Bunyip Review Podcast. I am your co-host, James the Bunnyman Willis, and I am here with my longtime co-host, Jonas Garway. How are you doing, Jonas?
I guess I'm a longtime co-host, aren't I? Like, I'm certainly not a short-time co-host.
You're significantly better than the original.
Fuck that other guy. Hi, thank you. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, it is nice to be here. All right, we're going to kick straight into the intro with our news and rewind. So Jonas, you've put on here new consoles. Now, if anyone is a long-term listener, just as you're a long-term co-host to this show, you'll know that I don't own consoles. I'm not a console guy. The last console I owned was a PS2. The idea that consoles can easily connect to the internet now freaks me out. So, Jonas, I take the floor on this one.
I mean, I just thought, like, who would we be running, like, a partially gaming review podcast to have a news section where we don't at least acknowledge the new generation of gaming consoles are here. They, I think, are also not queer. Again, I feel like we're really letting down the side. They're here and they're out. They're buyable, I guess. Do I own either of them? No. Will I own either of them? Yes. Probably the PlayStation. But it's certainly just an acknowledgement that, like, yeah, the new Xbox Series, Xbox One Series, vape through the whole Mega Drive. I don't know what they're called. I really hate Xbox's naming convention. It's getting more and more needless. Whereas at least, like, the PlayStation, quite boringly, just has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and I know when I'm getting the new one.
You know exactly what you're getting in for. You're getting in for the fifth of the PlayStation legacy.
Exactly. I am excited to get the PlayStation 5. Apparently the haptic feedback built in the controllers is built by the same people who made the haptic feedback available in the Switch Joy-Cons, which are kind of famous for having this ability to, like, simulate all sorts of feelings through varied and kind of like just incredibly tactile vibrations.
Yeah, that was the big thing when it came out. That was the big selling point, wasn't it? That you can you can really feel the rumble in not just a whir, but actually you can feel what you're holding.
Yeah, and like, so apparently one of the things I'm really looking forward to is holding this PlayStation controller in my hands and feeling things go from, like, my palm up to my fingers and forwards and back. And this sort of element that quite interesting and quite detailed experiences are going to be replicated through vibrations in my fingers. I think that's a really cool technology, and, like, as someone really into my consoles, like, yeah, I'm really looking forward to a lot of, like, the fighting games and a lot of those kind of, like, single player experiences that for me feel at home on the console.
But stepping with that perfect rumble, you're going to be stepping ever closer to that Black Mirror episode where you're going to be able to actually feel the fight, and then you're just going to do something a little bit different than fighting, and you're going to be able to feel it all through your controllers. Is that what you want? What do you want, Jonas?
Are you referring to the episode where he just bangs his best friend in a fight?
I am referring to that exactly, yes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, maybe not 2021, but, like, 2035, you know. I'm just saying. I think that's quite exciting, and I think for people who do console gaming because they can't afford gaming PCs, or for people who just like the reliability of a console, I think this is exciting, you know, because when a new console comes out, that opens up the floor for developers to get more experimental with what they're developing, not only for PC, but for consoles as well. So we're going to witness more impressive games come out now on the PC platform as well as the console platform, because, of course, you have to develop for both these days.
So are they more than just a hardware refresh? I mean, the haptic feedback thing is nice, but, like, is it more than just a power boost? Or
It's mostly a power boost. I mean, like, obviously, like, network connectivity and features and the ability to collaborate with, like, third-party apps like Netflix, Facebook, Twitter, these things normally get more and more integrated into the console over time. like you couldn't share content on the PS3 like you can on the PS4 quite so seamlessly. And the ability to play with friends obviously is becoming more and more desirable, as that is what makes PC gaming far more appealing. So trying to make consoles more like a PC seems to actually be the way that they're going. But it's hard to say much more until I kind of get my hands on one. But yeah,
fair enough. The chat asks what they like for backwards compatibility, which is a thing that I think is, I remember it being a real big deal back in the day, but I think nowadays, I mean, most stuff is digital anyway. Surely it can't be that hard to make things backwards compatible, at least the modern stuff.
Like, there's the argument that it shouldn't be that difficult to do, and then it doesn't happen. And I think that's a disappointment. Like, I would like a modern day console to play my wealth of PlayStation 2 games on, but I can't. So I have a PlayStation 2.
Right.
And yes, I could get a PlayStation 2 emulator, but then I have to also somehow give myself a credible reason for having the ISO and the ROMs available to me, which basically means, like, yes, I can own a physical copy of the game, but I then have to illegally go get myself the digital version for it to be playable on PC.
Yeah.
And there's also just that element of, like, if the consoles keep moving forward, eventually the tech to play the old games just won't exist. Like, you know, that PlayStation 2 won't last forever. And if I buy a new one in 10 years, well, how expensive or how prohibitive is that going to be for me, you know? I think it's a shame that backwards compatibility isn't considered a priority anymore. Yes, they do make digital versions of a lot of old games, but the fact is like, making digital versions of the most popular games is not the same as making a digital version of the games I remember playing. And giving me that nostalgia feel, which is a shame. I think there's probably like a far more intelligent and informed conversation you could have about that. I'm not the person who's going to have that conversation, unfortunately.
All right. Well, we'll move on to something that both of us definitely know loads and loads about, which is WoW Shadowlands came out since we last spoke. World of Warcraft is a game that I have famously mainly only played the worst expansions of. I have a habit of thinking, well, everyone seems to be really enjoying it, I'll pick it up, and then it goes downhill immediately. So when Shadowlands was announced, I wasn't really that interested in it after being totally burnt out, mainly by the community, not necessarily the actual gameplay on BFA. And so I haven't made the plunge into it. But a lot of the people I know who are playing it are saying that it's pretty good. It's one of the good ones. It's that famous World of Warcraft expansion cycle where there's a good one, a bad one, a good one, a bad one. And apparently this feels good to start with, whether that will keep up at all. Are you tempted to go back?
I didn't really get into Legion that much. And I think the reason I didn't get into Legion is because, like, A, I wasn't really playing with anyone. I was playing at the same time as people, and they were doing their own thing. And that was largely kind of my overall experience with WoW anyway. And I just found myself a bit like disconnected from it all. I don't know who these characters are. I have no emotional weight or context with regards to like what's being told to me at any point. I don't care who wins or loses any particular conflict. I don't care what's going on with all these narratives. I was kind of just playing it for the busy work, and I just found that there were other games out there where doing the busy work was more entertaining and like narratively fulfilling for me.
I agree. I think that World of Warcraft does a really bad job of introducing new players to the world, and they're trying to fix it with the level squish and with the new starting island and everything like that. And admittedly, I haven't played any of this stuff, and maybe it does fix it, but one of the big problems I had with WoW playing through it was, if you hadn't played all the way up to where you were today, all of the story is based on that, but that content cannot be played. You can't go back and do old raids. You can do the quests, but you only really get halfway through a zone before you have to move on because of leveling anyway. And And so you don't feel attached to that world. You feel dropped in this moment. And everyone's, I remember playing the very end of Legion and going through the class halls, and people come to me and be like, oh, that's a champion. Oh, I hear he killed Ragnaros or whatever. And I was like, I didn't do any of that stuff. I made this character this week. I boosted it up to this level, and I have no connection to this world. And obviously Final Fantasy kind of deals with that problem by going, no, you play through the whole game. Like you cannot, I mean, you can boost a character for money, but generally it's expected that you will have played through every part of the story. So by the time you hit Shadowlands, you have an attachment to all these characters, and that has its downsides in that I have been playing for like a year now, and I am only just reaching current content. I don't know. The two big things that made me fall out with WoW were that, the story stuff, and the fact that there was no real attachment to the world for newer players, but also that just the community I found was just awful. Like you say, like you felt like you were playing on your own, but even when you try and play with other players, there's a lot of like elitism in, like, if you want to do Mythic Plus, you have Raider.io, and you like heroic raiding is really difficult without finding a guild, and finding the right guild is really difficult unless you have a certain set of days free every week. So I'm impressed that WoW is still around, and I'm impressed that it's still putting out well-regarded expansions, but I don't know what WoW could do to bring me back.
Yeah, it makes me think that there should be... Is it not time for a different game? Is it not time for a sequel or something where you can start again from the beginning, but not necessarily detach yourself from the product that is World of Warcraft that you've come to know and play all these years? And I guess that, again, that's a conversation that someone who is not me will be better served having. But yeah, I'm not tempted to go back. If anything, I've struggled to get back into Final Fantasy XIV, and I really want to get back into Final Fantasy XIV a lot more, because I'm excited to see more of the content I've devoted myself to over the last year continue to be built upon and fleshed out, and for the story that I have experienced to keep going, because I have experienced all of it in the last year, as opposed to some of it over 15 years.
I agree. And not to go on with this too much longer, because this section will become most of the podcast, but I agree with your sentiment of starting again. I think there are a lot of structural problems in World of Warcraft that cannot be solved at this point, because they are just part of its DNA. And WoW Classic almost exemplifies that, this idea that communities are formed through reputation, and then reputation is not good enough because there are so many people playing the game that you need these external systems that sort of boil you down to numbers and stuff like that, or like an auction house, which is just fucking dreadful, and they've spent so long trying to fix it, but it's like a warren of code in this game. It might just be better to just blow the whole thing up and start again. Which Final Fantasy kind of feels like to me. It feels like the bits that I like about WoW are in there, but all of the bits I didn't like are fixed and better. You also put in Rewind, you put Sunless Skies, which is a game that I love, and that I know people in our chat love. How are you enjoying Sunless Skies, Jonas?
Yeah, I am really liking it. And I mean, so much more than I was prepared to from my experience of Sunless Seas. A couple of people in chat now will sort of be like aware that I've been streaming this and tuning in and watching me go through the Sunless Skies. And what I've said on the stream, and it's still true here, I played a little bit of Sunless Seas. Mary and I kind of played it together. And I found the difficulty in Sunless Seas to be quite prohibitive, which meant that I was less willing to take risks, less willing to engage with unknown areas, and would play it safe and then die anyway. And I would get frustrated by that, lose a lot of progress, and have to start all over again. And after about 4 or 5 runs, that kind of just became like a cycle that didn't appeal to me, not in the same way that like a roguelike does. And having played Skies, like, I've died once in Skies. Yes, I made the difficulty incredibly easy for myself, but that was as a direct response to my experience in Seas. But in doing that, I'm having a really enjoyable journey. Like, I'm confident that I can get to places with very few resources. And I feel confident kind of taking certain risks in the dialogue, because I know that seeing the negative outcome is part and parcel of the experience, but won't punish me nearly as much. I just think there's a lot there, and I'm really enjoying exploring it at my pace.
It's interesting, because I never felt like Sunless Seas was too difficult, right? Like, I it took me a long time to die the first time I played it, and when I first played Skies, I thought, oh, the controlling in this is horrible, I hate this. And I think when I reviewed it on here, I said, like, I really liked Seas because I had a grasp on how everything worked. And then Skies felt like it was Seas, but they'd stripped a lot of the nuance out of it and put this driving system in, which I hate, on top of it. And it was only when I came back and we streamed it, and I was focusing less on the mechanics of the game and more on talking to people and then engaging in the story, that I started to love it as much as Seas. I think it's interesting. It's another interesting thing about the way we play games, in that, like, you're right in that you, when you're playing a game on your own, you just want to play it at your pace. And some games, and Seas included, does not allow you to do that. it says, this is the difficulty of the game, and if you don't want this, tough luck, that's what you're playing. And Skies does a bit say, no, you can take this out of it, and you can take that out of it, and the death isn't so punishing and stuff like that. I think
I actually really like, I'm slightly the opposite. I love the controls in Skies. I love that I feel that there is this, like, my skill can overcome death, because I can dodge those bullets, and I can fucking, like, kind of chicken that, what is that fish that just farts and charges at you?
I can't remember off the top of my head.
Like Chakibrati or whatever, but like it comes at you and like you can duke it with like a little sidestep and have it smash a wall.
I will admit, Seas combat is crap, especially because one of the things, Cantankery is the thing that you're talking about, that Seas combat is crap, and very quickly we learn that the best way to kill anything is to go right up behind it and then just follow it, because that nothing has a turning circle small enough to catch you if you're directly behind it.
Yeah,
and their AI would just try and get them to turn. And so you just follow them in a circle.
Rather than do a on-the-spot 360.
So as soon as you do that, all combat in that game is just done. Like, it's just the easiest game in the world.
Okay.
Which is part of why when Sky suddenly to me felt like, oh my god, everything is so horribly dangerous. Because admittedly, the AI is still horrible in that game, but I was bumping into walls and shit a lot more often.
Yeah, well, I've come up with a few barriers, like ghosty boys, but honestly, having a lot of fun, thought it was worth mentioning because you reviewed it so well, and I know you still have a relationship with the game even now.
I don't think I reviewed it that well. I actually think I was pretty down on it before I played, because I hadn't played much of it.
I suppose outside of the podcast, you review it well. You talk about the game positively outside the podcast. And I know it's a game that's like just filled with the brim of all this incredible writing. So yeah, glad to be playing it. Thought it was worth mentioning. That's all from me.
Cool. All right. Well, speaking of incredible writing, we're about to move on to our TV section. So I've got to update everything myself because lockdown's taken my technician away from me. Hold on. Just going to quickly update things. Here we go. This will be a great segment of the audio podcast. Bet you're loving this, everybody.
And as Jamie updates the section, we're now moving on to television.
So my television show for this month, and if you follow me on Twitter or you follow me in Jonas's Twitch stream chat, you may have heard me talk about this glowingly already. For this month, I'm talking about The Queen's Gambit. The Queen's Gambit I watched because Rotten Tomatoes gave it 100%. And then about a couple of weeks after it came out, after a bunch of reviews had come in, it still had 100%. And then having watched it all, and now looking back on it, I think it still has 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. And I have to say, I genuinely agree with that. It is fucking great. So if you don't know anything about The Queen's Gambit, It is a Netflix series about a woman called Beth Harmon, who is a prodigious chess player. And it sort of follows her as she navigates life from and competition from quite a troubled start. It is one of the best TV shows I think I've ever seen. It gets almost everything right. And even thinking back to it right now, I both want more of it. And I'm pretty glad it ended exactly where it did. I've spoken a lot on this this show about shows that know when to end, that they go on just about as long as they need to, and this is absolutely one of those shows. So the story paints a life born of early trauma. Beth is orphaned in a car accident which kills her mum, and the show follows her from here to encountering chess for the first time, being played in the basement of the orphanage that she ends up in, to competing in tournaments across America, and eventually taking on chess greats. What impressed me about this show was the intricacies and subtlety of how they set up these traumas that she encounters, and how they explore them, and how they explore how they shape her as a person. It avoids these sort of broad strokes that we've come to expect from tales of childhood trauma, instead showing events born both of sort of reasonable misunderstandings or outdated ideas that are both minor and life-altering, depending on the perspective that you see them from. Like, for example, the head of the orphanage banning Beth from playing chess can be seen as a defining traumatic moment of her authoritarian childhood, or experience from Beth's point of view, or it can be a totally reasonable reaction to a child stealing stuff and sneaking into the basement from the head teacher's perspective. It helps make these moments building Beth's character with traumas that are both at once heartbreaking and totally reasonable feel both surprising and inevitable at the same time. You expect the sleazy dickhead to force her into the sex because it's set in the 40s and 50s and 60s. You expect the violent schoolmistress to lock her in a cupboard or something like that. And when they don't, it feels like a twist. Yet what does happen feels both totally earned and completely grounded, and often not much less traumatic than those really over-the-top things that I suggested. The first episode starts with a flash forwards, and by the time you reach that scene in the show, it feels absolutely earned. Beth feels like a fully fleshed out character, and every action she takes is informed by the life that she's led, and every bad habit formed over a life of unfortunate circumstances. So the story is great, well worth a watch. Mechanically though, the show is an absolute marvel. The acting in it is superb. Anya Taylor-Joy is incredible in the role of Beth. Just the way she moves betrays her inner state absolutely perfectly. It feels like everything she does is choreographed, and yet still a sort of a totally natural expression of what she's trying to do. And it helps build the chess scenes into more than just watching two people intensely stare at a board. I don't know anything about chess. I basically know the rules, but I couldn't tell you what they were doing in most of the games. But they make each game feel like a battle to behold, and all of the tension is betrayed in the faces and the bodies of the players absolutely perfectly. You can read what's going on just by watching the way that they move and the way that they look at each other. And of course, there's also scenes where Beth will explain a chess game to someone who's supposed to be basically a chess Luddite, and so you get the intricacies through her in a way that totally makes sense for the world, but also sort of explains it in quite a dramatic detail and from her point of view, which the show so heavily is. Artistically, they also aren't afraid to play with the styles of the times. The costumes and the sets in the show feel immaculate, like perfectly to their time. But also the styles of editing and the way the games are shot draws from where and when they're supposed to be, from early 70s stuff with sort of hip montage kind of scenes to the sort of dark coldness of Soviet Russia towards the end. Just every scene where there's a chessboard, everything about that shot sums up what brought them to that chessboard or where that chessboard is. And it's so good. I cannot recommend this show enough. I finished it both wishing there was more of this show and just 100% pleased with the ending. And I'm sure once we get talking about it, I could talk about this show for ages and ages, because every episode I watched with Laura afterwards, we were just talking for about 20 minutes about the show. Have you seen the show, Jonas? You looked quite confused when I spoke about the early stuff.
Okay, answer to your question, yes, I've seen the show. We talked about it actually on my stream. I fucking love this show, and I agree with everything you said. The look of confusion on my face is, do you remember which character Benny is?
He's
the cowboy-ish character.
Yeah.
So you were talking about how the show's got 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. So I double checked. Yes, it's still got 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. Great. Benny is played by an actor called Thomas Sangster, whose profile photo is him as a child, because he's in Love Actually, and like he's most well known for like Phineas and Ferb, and like,
well, he's most well known for being Jojen in Game of Thrones,
and Jojen in Game of Thrones, and he appears in like Maze Runner and all this stuff, but like,
yeah,
in a lot of these, you know, he's got this youthful face on his profile from when he must have been like, I don't know, 14 or something, and it's so weird now that I know who Benny is, like. It's just so weird looking at his like child.
He looks really young, and it's kind of weird seeing him in this role, because the role is supposed to be older, and he is playing, I think, the age he is, but he looks so young. He looks so young that whole thing. But it's like the least important part of this.
No, you're right. But I wanted to explain like the look on my face when you were exploring this, okay, because I was just so baffled by who he is.
So what did you think of the show? Yeah,
I love the show. I thought it was really cool. I went into this show thinking it was something to do with royalty.
Like you said, yeah.
Yeah, because the show's called Queen's Gambit, right? And like, you know, it shows like a woman like very well dressed, very well kept, with this kind of like this very almost periodic look to how she's like addressing the camera and frames herself. And there's chess, which is like quite analog. So it's like, what time period could that take place in? Well, any really, it doesn't matter. So then like she's in an orphanage, right? And I'm like, yeah, one of her parents is royalty. I know it. And then she's like, gets adopted. And I'm like, yeah, no. And don't worry, the royal blood, it's going to come up. And then eventually I learn why the show is called Queen's Gambit. And I'm like, what? No, is it just about chess? And it's just about chess. But yeah, expertly so. Absolutely expert. You're talking about how...
I think you might be the only person who had this experience with this show.
It's because I didn't look up... I try to go into shows blind, right? Like, right. If I know I'm going to watch a show, I just click play.
I just like that you went through multiple episodes of a show that entirely focuses on chess. Like, every episode is heavily about chess.
Yes.
And you went... And then the moment where they you had an epiphany halfway through the show where you went, it's a show about chess.
It's a show only about, you know. I thought that she was like, the character is the Queen's Gambit. You know what I mean? Something like that. But yeah, no, just very, I felt very dumb. It's expert. Like you were talking about how the show kind of like, tells you about the chess by making it happen kind of in universe. I love the fact that these tournaments would have these professional men in suits who their entire job was in a mostly like non-digital world where you couldn't display things through a digital screen or a camera. You had men with a live whiteboard who were moving the pieces around on this like massive whiteboard with magnets or pieces of paper and blue tack. And the matches were happening so quickly that you could, I felt this visible sense of stress on them, these characters in the background who were trying to keep up with what's happening on the board, to then tell this audience members of hundreds of people watching. And I thought that was such an incredible, like, nod to the to not only like the stress of the game, but to like the real world practicalities of how do you nationalize this into onto a sport level? How do you and have I ever seen competitive chess? Of course not. I don't know if it's that's what they do in real life, but there was such a good focus on it cinematically.
So I've read a few things afterwards, and now my YouTube recommendations are all just like videos from chess masters talking about the show. But there's a lot of stuff that they took directly from real life chess stuff that I think is that sort of special sauce that makes the chess stuff feel right. Even if you've never played chess before or never seen professional chess, all of the games are based on real games that they then adjust and things. They had chess grandmasters there helping them do everything. One of the guys was one of the videos I watched was talking about how in modern day chess you can't have an adjournment anymore. You know how multiple times in the show adjourn and they put a note in the piece of paper in an envelope saying this is what my next move will be, and then the next day they come back, the adjudicator makes that move, and then they carry on. And that basically gives the other person who didn't make the move a day to think, what's he going to play? You can't do that in modern chess because you could just have a machine just run all the possible options and work out what the best thing is.
Exactly. Because one thing I really loved about some of those last episodes were the moments where the game was so close to ending that there could only be potentially a couple of hundred moves left in terms of like the actual finite combinations of meaningful moves, and having these players actually sit there and be like, right, statistically, this is what could happen. And for each statistical eventuality, here are your three options that we think should happen. And I thought that was really cool, like a really fun and smart thing about chess, right? Is actually trying to reason that out.
The whole show is, I mean, there's so many levels to this show in like the way Beth interacts with people, the way Beth interacts with society and the world and fashion and what she should be doing, but also the way that people, like at its core, it's written and designed by people who clearly give a shit about chess, the game itself and the mechanical nature of the game, and this constant dilemma between preparation and instinctive play, right? And this like this her whole thing of repeatedly going into things feeling like, oh, I just go as I go, and I look at old games but not really to practice, just to see what happened kind of thing, and have an idea of the game. And that there are all these scenes where she is sitting trying to think about what her next move would be and just not able to do it, or going off and doing other things, or constantly getting distracted, and all the other chess players around her, whenever there's an adjournment, are always like puzzling everything out. And it comes down to like this climactic moment in the final episode where she's having to do that kind of thing and having to go through this situation. And they, even though you don't know, even though as a non-chess player, you don't know really instinctive, like actually what she's puzzling out, right? You don't know. I couldn't possibly tell you in any moment what she needed to do to win in any of the scenes, but you get it. You totally get like what she's going through, why she's going through it, exactly what's happening. And this is the interesting thing about watching the video, that one of the videos I watched earlier, it was about the last game in the show where there is an adjournment in the middle of it, and they talked about the way the game plays up until the adjournment and then what happens afterwards, and how everything up until the adjournment is a real life game that was actually played by two grandmasters, and then everything afterwards is different because the real life one ended in a draw and the show ends slightly differently to that. And they were talking about like that this video gave me the sense that if you know chess, you could watch this show and have absolutely 100% an idea of all the drama that's taking place on that board. And it's amazing that it works on both levels, right? You don't get chess people looking at it being like, oh, I wouldn't do that. Oh God, I can't believe they did that. Chess people are going, Beth Harmon is the greatest chess player ever to have lived. And I can see why. She doesn't seem ridiculously good. She seems just like a really great chess player.
No, I think there's an incredible art, right, to taking something that is already spectacular within the real world, something that already has a incredible amount of history, depth, knowledge, and kind of specialism to it, and being able to replicate that for the screen, but to the point that you're not phoning it in, to the point that you're not sensationalizing any of it, or unnecessarily exaggerating or hyping anything beyond your own abilities, if that makes sense. As does tend to be the case with like a lot of these kind of like, oh, here's a story of a man who succeeded at something in the real world. Yeah, it's cool. It's like,
but even on top of that, like Mary's saying in chat about it's nice when they make a point of researching these things properly. But the thing about this show is that it's not like it. The chess is like a thing in the background, like a Linux computer, and you go, oh, they got the stuff on the screen correct for when they were hacking or something. It is the central part of the show. Like, this mechanically has to work, and it has to work enough that all of the drama makes sense throughout the show, that all of the wins and losses and draws make sense. And then it also makes sense in a finite detail, like, oh, she is a human being who's making human moves and human mistakes, but she's also exactly the right level of player she should be, which is a crazy line to walk, right? She's not the Iron Man of chess. She's a human being who plays chess amazingly well, and they walk that line perfectly. But even outside of the chess, the thing that really blew my mind about this show was how they just handled every part of her life. It's been so long, or maybe I've never seen a show about childhood trauma that paints the trauma itself as so nuanced and so fine stroked. None of this broad, like, she was beaten as a kid or that kind of thing. I mean, admittedly, in the first thing that happens to her is her mother dies. But outside of that, like, everything that happens to her has a nuance and it could go either way. It could be a misunderstanding, or it could be a defining horrible thing that happened to her. It could be a totally reasonable punishment to give a kid, or it could be like an actual genuine horrible thing that's happened to her. And all of this builds to her being this woman who, whenever she does anything that is self-destructive, or whenever she has trouble interacting with a person, all of it makes sense. All of it feels inevitable. And the fact that it's not chaotic and over the top feels like a twist. It feels surprising. It feels surprising when people give her speeches about the way that she's acting, and they don't feel like grand speeches. They feel about the length that a person would think before speaking and then stop. I really, really love this show. And I have to say, anyone in chat who, or listening to the audio podcast, who has not seen this show, you have to see it. It has to be the best thing on Netflix at the moment.
Yes. I didn't know when you were going to stop there.
I realized that and I thought I'd just wait.
I feel like we also just haven't, you know, just touch on the supporting cast in this show are absolutely phenomenal. I think Bill Camp as Mr. Scheibel, acting as this reluctant mentor who over time starts to realize what it is he's kind of touching upon, is really quite, like, at first it was like quite inconsequential. I didn't think much of his character, but as the show went on, and actually as he wasn't a main character, I actually ended up having a lot of respect and like love for his character, that in a later episode we kind of returned to just a little bit, and it really kind of affirmed my feelings for his character. Like the overwhelming kind of like and dominating presence of like Vasily Borgov, this like dangerous Soviet chess player, who we never really get to know him, but he acts as like a really good threat always in the background of everything that is happening once we start to learn about the tournament level play.
But again, even with Borgov, he's another great example of point of view, in that Borgov is this like, and he's the closest the show has to an antagonist, and even then he is constantly nice to Beth. He is constantly like,
yeah, like, really, like, respectful.
Like, really respectful. There's a point in which he, like, there's multiple points in which he outright praises her. And there are so many moments where he looks at her with just this sort of, this glower, glum face that in the moment, the first time you see it, you think, oh, he's horrible, he's intimidating her. And the second time you see it, it reads more as, oh, he's disappointed. Because he expected more from her. He really believed in her and she wasn't delivering in this moment or something. And the whole show doesn't go out of its way to be like, this is a show about perspectives. You don't know. Like, it depends on who's looking at what. But at every moment, anything that happens could be viewed either as quite threatening and dangerous to her, or actually, you know, maybe not so bad. Maybe someone's just made a misunderstanding, or they do care, but they're also they're disappointed rather than angry at you or something. It's
And just also, like, shout outs to characters like Jolene, who in the orphanage I think is like a really wonderful counterpart to Beth, and like, it just made me so happy to see who she grows up to be. I think one of my favorite elements of the show is just as the tournaments go on, you meet all of these like various white American dudes at like varying levels of the tournament ladder, and their influences on Beth and how they continue to be a part of her life as she grows up and finds her way to the, you know, these higher echelons of like tournament level. I love how she keeps re-encountering them, how they keep coming back, how they go from someone that she beat mindlessly on day one to someone who she ends up approaching out of her own whim of like friendship and sense of like curiosity and desire to talk about chess, because that's something that her character doesn't display much of, as a desire to interact with people. But she loves talking to the chess people about chess. And I think it's necessary to have those characters there as a conduit for like us to see Beth's personality. How does Beth actually kind of like display joy and passion and things like that outside of being in the moment of chess?
And things like, does she want relationships because it's a thing that she's seen others have, or is it something she actually wants? Does she want to sleep with specific people, or is it because of her childhood of growing up and seeing the older girls going off and making out with guys and thinking that's what I should be doing, that's a life kind of thing? And these little bits from various authority figures that she's gleaned and glued together. I mean, I could talk about this show forever and ever and ever. Things like representation. Like, Jolene is fucking great. Like, we talked about it with someone in your chat was talking about the idea that like it's men don't interact with her the way that men would have done in the 40s. Like, there's no like real patronizing or anything like that. And to that I would say that there actually is a fair bit of it. It's just not overt. It's just not like heavy-handed, just like get back to the kitchen kind of stuff, which you'd expect from a show like this to use as shorthand for she's had trauma, and it doesn't need to go there. And in every aspect of every other character in the show, you see evidence of that kind of societal stuff happening. The girl that she went to school with ending up being a housewife who's got bottles of booze all in her bag,
and they've all sneaking booze. Yeah,
the other girl she meets in the tournament never really making it very far in the tournament, and at, like, never pursuing it and stuff like that, and all these various things that, like, it's definitely there. It's just not about that. I could talk about this forever and ever and ever, but we've got to move on because otherwise we'll never get to talk about anything else. All right, well, if I were to sum it up in a sentence, I'd say the best show on Netflix. Go watch this show. All right, we're gonna move on to Jonas's review for this month. Jonas, what are you reviewing in television?
The television show that I'll be reviewing this month is Auntie Donna's Big Old House of Fun. So let's just jump straight in. Auntie Donna's Big Old House of Fun. It's a 6-part series on Netflix in which Auntie Donna, made up of Broden, Mark and Zach, 3 Australian comedians, sort of rework many of their existing live and YouTube comedy sketches into a series of sketches taking place in, around, or on the television of their Big Old House of Fun. Now, I'm a big fan of their YouTube channel. I've seen them live several years ago. I love their comedy. It's energetic. It's wild. It's like super character driven, which makes it kind of very easy to transfer onto the screen already, especially if they have so much experience performing sketches on YouTube just over like the last 10 years. The show itself has no real narrative to review. There is not a plot, there is not a story, there are no spoilers. Each episode kind of has a theme that acts as a driving force for a lot of the events you see within the show. So like in episode 4, they all prepare for a date, and then that's used to facilitate a joke or a sketch in which Broden, the bold one, goes to get his hair cut at the barber's. As they offer him IPAs and crack the bottles in their mouths, they drill tattoos on into their arm while he sat there in the chair and spray miscellaneous liquids of Jack Daniel's sriracha sauce and hawk semen, all while dancing to techno music dressed in flannel shirts and waistcoats. Some of the sketches and songs within the show are completely new, or as far as I know, because I haven't listened to the podcast, like Morning Brown or character of the Piss Inspector. Some jokes are things that they performed live on stage, like their Ellen sketch or Blair Boyant, the Clairvoyant. Or some of the sketches are directly kind of taken from their YouTube channel and remixed into the context of the show, such as like the sketch where they do roll call is kind of reworked into them interviewing for new housemates. The episodes are mixed and edited super tightly, so there's pretty much no chance to recover from one joke before you're thrust into the next one. But the show plays close attention to the pacing and energy so that no two jokes side by side feel similar. Some of the jokes or characters are called back in later episodes to kind of have like really powerful punchlines with the callback humor, of such as like Zach doing his own sketch comedy characters within the sketch show he is already acting in. And we also get loads of guest actors, comedians, voices and performances that kind of makes the cast feel more varied and alive than it would have been otherwise if it was just the three of them. They've also done loads of, like, Auntie Donna have done loads of meta marketing for the show on like their YouTube channel and like just all this weird shit, which kind of gives the series this weird sense that it has a much longer shelf life than it would if it was just a show on Netflix. They do live commentary on YouTube, which means you end up rewatching the episodes alongside the YouTube video of them giving live commentary, giving you an excuse to go back and watch those episodes again. And like a YouTube sketch, there are catchy songs and memorable jokes that are so easy to kind of want more of that I have found myself going back to episodes just to rewatch that 3 or 4 minutes and relive that joke with like a newfound perspective or just a sense of, haha, I want to hear the beat again. The comedy is absurd and varied. I think there's like Auntie Donna kind of feel like they've got such a huge catalog to them. There is at least one joke in every episode that will like put a smile on your face, even if they are so overtly not your kind of group, or alternatively just have you in stitches laughing for the whole episode. Things like watching Mark mime his own sex scene, Zach reprise the role of Lord Whoopi, or Broden as Cowdoy has truly enriched my life in ways that I don't think I can do justice to on the podcast. Jamie, I know you've watched this. I know you're a big fan. How did you feel about the Netflix show?
I really liked it. I thought it was really good. I think there's been an intense lack of good quality sketch TV comedy in a while. Like, we're big fans of things like Mitchell and Webb and stuff like that. And since then, I feel like a lot of TV comedy, admittedly, I don't watch a massive amount of TV comedy these days, but for the main reason being that it feels like it's, you know, give a famous comedian a show with his name in it and he'll vaguely work something out. Yeah. And they all feel the same, and they all feel kind of like, oh, here's the funny thing about being an awkward man in life kind of thing. And the thing that Auntie Donna's Big Old House of Fun has done is create something that has an identity, that feels like it has a purpose for being, that it is genuinely something brand new. And it's really funny for that, even though a lot of the stuff, if you're a big fan of their stuff, you'll have heard before, like you'll have seen the various sketches in their live shows or on YouTube, or heard them working out the characters on the podcast or stuff like that. The show is the perfect distilled versions of those sketches, really lovingly done, with so many other just weird, strange bits in between. And as well, like, that they really put a depth of humor into every frame. Like you were saying before about like there being really good pace in jokes. There's also jokes upon jokes upon jokes upon jokes. Like there's one of my favorite jokes in one of the episodes is there's an episode about dating, and there's like, there's a rapid section of jokes where they do a song at the beginning, and then they get an email and the computer starts floating, and then they all get big nets and they try and catch the computer. And then they run into this scene where like the one of the characters, one of the, I think Zach is playing this like ancient Frenchman, and relatable. Zach also needs to be in the scene as himself. And so there's a mannequin dressed as Zach. And so that's like four different jokes on top of each other in rapid succession. And then later on in that episode, just because they needed to send another email, there's a bit where the Broden sat using the computer watching the previous sketch and saying, I like this. And then the computer just starts lifting up and he goes, no, not again, not again. And it's just like these like joke upon joke upon joke upon joke really squashed together.
It's really rapid fire. Like it is so incredible how it's not, here's a sketch, and there's a very clear end to the sketch, and when that sketch ends, the next sketch starts. They move like fluidly into the next one, into the next one, into the next one, into the next one. And like, as you're saying, like sometimes those layers, those sketches will layer on top of each other. Just like there were actually so many moments where a character is replaced by a mannequin, or quickly Broden will play a character, will turn right to the exit the scene, the camera will take a new perspective, will watch Broden's character walk out the room as Broden, now playing a different character, walks into frame on the left, and they all address the fact that someone is just walking outside their house and Broden just missed it. And it's like, that's 3 seconds. It's not really a joke, but it's funny how they execute it. Like it really is done with a purposeful sense of it'll be funny when we do this. Fuck. I'm really happy that this show happened, right? Like I think there is so few examples of something that feels as small and niche as like a YouTube sketch comedy group kind of making it to the live performance stage, where they get to do tours, where you get to go see them live, where you get to kind of just see them a little bit more fleshed out than just like the 4 or 5 minutes that they might have on YouTube. And then to even take that beyond, and rather than like being actors in a narrative show, they just take the sketch comedy that they've always been doing, the content that you've always been subscribed to, and just give it that injection of Netflix money. Not to mention, like, I think having all of those guest actors come in and stuff, and like all of their friends from YouTube sketches, like over the past 6 years, come in and like play weird roles. Like Weird Al Yankovic plays a vampire or something for a whole episode. It's so weird, but it's excellent. It is excellent because it is unlike anything else I would get to watch on Netflix. And it's unlike anything that they would have been able to do off their own back on YouTube.
I think it feels like it's a complete idea. It feels like it's not just translating it from YouTube, although a lot of it is. It feels like they had an idea for what they wanted to do, and it is a complete set of shows. And I think that's a really great thing about it. I absolutely, if you want a light comedy, and you just want something wacky and just something to have on, even just in the background, because there's a joke a minute, so you'll keep it up. Watch this show. Watch Queen's Gambit and then watch this show. And I think that would be like the perfect week, I think.
Watch this in between the episodes of Queen's Gambit.
Watch them at the same time. So you have just them get on side whiplash. By side. The perfect companion piece, I think.
Absolute whiplash. Okay, Jamie, I'm gonna assume that you'd like me to wrap this up in a single sentence.
I was literally about to say that. You jumped ahead of me.
Yeah, what can I say? Sometimes it's I like that, to be.
It's all that Ring Fit. It's giving you a bit more pep. It's made you a bit more like ready to go.
I don't know if that's the effect that the Ring Fit's having on me. But hey, yeah, sure. We'll say so. Auntie Donna's Big Old House of Fun. If I had to summarize this in a single sentence, I would just say. The perfect evolution to what was already incredible YouTube sketch comedy.
Okay, good.
Such a shit sentence. I'm so sorry.
Well, I quite enjoyed that at the beginning of it. All right, we're going to move on to video games. So it's my video game first this month. And this month, I'm reviewing a game that I'm going to say right now, I don't really recommend. But I played quite a bit of it.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to be talking about it. So my game for this month is called My Time at Portia. Now, I don't know how many of you have heard of this, but basically it's an indie Kickstarter game about building a workshop in a place called Portia. It's a third person 3D, and you play a builder, someone who runs a workshop and handles various odd fabrication jobs around the town, who has arrived in Portia, which is known for its ancient ruins. And at first, it feels like a lot of these normal management games, right? It's very Stardew-esque in its setup. You're new, you gradually learn to make new things, meet villagers, find love, learn about the town, yada, 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 yada. And it handles a lot of this stuff fine. In a similar vein to my Graveyard Keeper review, this game strikes me a lot as an indie game that wants to do every idea that came to their head. And as such, the quality of the various different things varies quite a bit. For example, constructing large things like bridge pieces or large machines requires attaching raw materials to a blueprint on a big assembly platform, which is pretty cool. I like that. Like, it gives a feeling of constructing something large rather than just pressing a big craft button in a menu, right? That doesn't really give that. On the other hand, making like second tier resources out of raw resources is intensely time gated, with machines that make these things taking literal hours to churn through backlogs of stuff. And this feels like it's trying to encourage you to go out and experience more of the game while you're doing these things. But then a lot of the jobs are given timers, so that make these slow machines feel kind of just unfair. Like, you should have had the stock of refined mats ready to go before you took the job, even though you didn't know what the job was. Also, content is often kind of soft gated behind construction, which very quickly opens up to requiring mats from loads of different very slow machines, themselves built with other very slow machines, meaning you can be told, here is the next quest marker, and realize that that is literally 2 in-game weeks away from being possible. The glacial pace works for Stardew because its days are quite short and its side content or resource gathering is quite solidly put together. So like in Stardew, the mining is pretty solid. The fishing game makes sense. So you can plan your days while you wait for plants to grow. And even when there's nothing, even then, there's nothing that really requires more than like a day or two of genuinely being inactive to construct. Like, usually you're out getting the things and then you can use them pretty much immediately. When you're waiting for stuff in Portia, you have a bunch of activities that are technically complete, but just a bit short of being really done. So combat, for example, is passable, but unsatisfying. You very quickly feel like there's very little strategy to its slash and roll gameplay, even ignoring the massive frame drops I would get every time I'd get into combat, which I know isn't a feature of the game, but fuck, man, it made combat quite difficult. Mining involves big featureless caves in which you can deform the scenery in sort of No Man's Sky terrain deforming style to hunt down objects from the past buried in the ground, which is a cool concept, but the utter lack of any kind of detail makes it feel like you're just wandering around a tech demo. But in essence, if you don't look too hard, the basic gameplay loop is fun, or fun enough that it kept me playing for quite a while. It always carries the promise of more content, be it new featureless caves that you can wander around in or learning more about the villagers around you. And the construction of the whole thing is rough enough to have that exciting feeling that anything can happen around the next corner. At one point I was wandering about and I just bumped into a big bear in his pajamas, and I had no idea if he was connected to a story or what. And there's enough thought behind the game for it to feel like there will be more satisfying progression, but not enough follow through on those things for it to feel like a game I should recommend. I will say there is one thing that I did find very interesting about this game, and it might actually make me come back to it to just explore it a bit more if I have a bunch of time on my hands, and that is the setting of the game. It starts in this sort of semi-techy but mostly rural world, and then you're introduced to the backstory via members of a church that wants to remove all technology from the world, like a hippie Brotherhood of the Steel. The backstory is that this world was wiped out by some crazy future robot war, and we are all in the post-apocalyptic ashes rebuilding society, but we're far enough into the post-apocalypse that everyone is sort of basically rurally happy. They've built up enough that they are like rural technology again, and no one remembers the event because they're all too young. It was so long ago. They've just got these sort of murals and these ruins full of ancient robot tech and things like that, and some of the ruins are still patrolled by the robots from the war, and people are sort of starting to edge towards re-teching up, and it looks like the story is going towards this idea of, or maybe we might be moving towards causing the same thing to happen again. And is it really a good idea to make all this progress? Like, is it maybe better to stay closer, or like exploring ruins and finding more about what happened to this war? And that story seems pretty interesting. They are making a game called, they're kickstarting another game called My Time at Sandrock at the moment, which is, it was going to be an expansion, but it's now becoming a sequel. And it sounds like a lot of what they're doing in Sandrock is fixing a lot of the things I've talked about here. So it might actually genuinely be that Sandrock is maybe a playable, recommendable game, possibly. Maybe we'll see. Jonas, I assume you haven't played this game, and knowing you, it doesn't sound like your kind of game, but I'll ask anyway.
So you touched on this game last month, and I have not thought about it anymore since you mentioned it last month.
Right.
So no, I've not played of it. No, I think I got it in the same humble bundle as you. It's not a game that I've given any more thought to than that. As Squig has mentioned in the chat, but it did occur to me while you were talking about it, that element of the game that's tempting you to draw you back, right? This idea that there was once a civilization made up of high tech, and it is so long ago that no one can really even comment on what that civilization was. But there are remnants of it, and there's evidence that perhaps going towards that civilization may bring upon ruin again. That is reminiscent of two of my favorite JRPGs of all time. One is Final Fantasy X, the first Final Fantasy X game I ever played. And eternally one of my favorites. And the other is a little bit more niche, called Star Ocean Till the End of Time, in which humanity reaches a certain point of progress, and then an alien race are sent to destroy all of humanity, and their role is to make sure that humanity never exceeds a certain level of like technological success.
Like Mass Effect.
Not unlike Mass Effect is what I will say. I think that element in storytelling is like, it's been done before, but it is fascinating because.
But I think the thing with Portia, and I think the reason that Portia would bring me back, like those games maybe wouldn't necessarily, apart from the fact that I'm not much of a turn-based strategy game, not turn-based strategy, but turn-based RPG game person, is that in this world, you are a builder, right? You're going around, you're building stuff, you're building technology, you're making an impact on the world because you're building up your workshop and stuff like that. And so it's not a, the story is bringing you to the point where at some point you will push the world over the edge. It's a, you don't ever have to go there, right? You don't even have to do that. You could just spend all of your life going, you know what, the church people are right. I'll just sit here and build necklaces for the rest of my life. And that you actively have to push yourself further. And now I don't know if the game goes that way, but the potential that it might, the potential that at some point, because one of the mechanics of the game is you can find these data disks in the ground in these featureless caves that you can dig through, and you can give the data disks either to the church and they'll dispose of them, or you can give them to a research lab. And if you give them to the research lab, they give you blueprints for new things you can build, right? From the stuff that they found on the data disks. And there's, every step of the way, there's this thing in my head going, what if they give me, what if I give them a data disk and they give me the plans to a bomb? Or like, or they give me the plans to a death robot. Do I build it? Do I do that? Would I do that? Would I destroy the idyllic paradise that is Portia?
I guess, like, I can understand why that is slightly more exciting than anything else. You know, I get why that's an exciting element of the game. Do you realistically, given what you've been streaming, and given that you'll have to play something new next month, how likely is it, though, that you are going to go back to it, given that you don't think you can recommend it to somebody else?
I think that when the times that I've played quite a bit of it, I think. I can actually find out how much time I've spent on it. Because I have played, 17.8 hours of this game, right? Mm-hmm. But the majority of that time that was spent playing that game was on days where a client cancelled me and I suddenly had a day where I had nothing to do, and that's when I played it, right? Or it was a weekend and they announced the national lockdown, so I was no longer going to see Laura or something, and so I just suddenly had a block of time that I wasn't doing anything else. And I think if it was like you have an hour before the stream where you can just play a game, just get a bit of game time to yourself, or every morning I play a bit of Final Fantasy kind of thing. If someone said to me, you could play this instead, you could play Portia every morning instead, you're right, I probably wouldn't. Okay. wouldn't go back to it in those situations.
Yeah. Okay, well, because I mean, yeah, in that sense, it doesn't feel like, in your review of this game, it doesn't feel like you want to sell it to me. And I don't feel sold on it.
No, I don't think so. I think that, like, if you wanted a game like this, like, the only thing selling you on this is the potential that there could be a good story, and the fact that it does try to delve into new stuff, like the 3D aspect of it. If you want a really good polished version of this, you play Stardew Valley. And if you want a sort of innovative, but maybe a bit like frayed at the edges version of this, you play Graveyard Keeper. I don't think you play this. Yep. So yeah.
Yep. Okay, cool.
Cool. All right. Well, if I were to sum it up in a sentence, I would say it's fine, but there's better. Okay, cool. All right, we're gonna move on to Jonas's review for this month. My stream info crashed, so I can't update the title.
Can you do it in chat with a slash command or an exclamation mark?
I don't know.
You don't have any of the bots that'll do that, will
okay,
you?
Okay, I know. Hold on, I've fixed it.
It's fine. Cool. This doesn't matter to the audio version anyway, so I'm going to carry on with my review.
All right, so Jonas, what are you reviewing for this month?
I'm reviewing actually, we have a commonality here. This is a game that I also got from my humble choices. And it's a game, how to put it? It's called Smile For Me, right? The game is called Smile For Me. It was part of the sort of November/December humble choice. And initially, when I redeemed this game and added it to my library alongside the 12 other games or whatever, I had no interest in it. I had no idea what I was clicking on. I just added it and moved on. But in a desperate bid to avoid reviewing yet another great Yakuza game, because they're not very different, I impulse played this game on like a spare Saturday with Mary. We just decided that game, we clicked play, and we just went in. And I was not disappointed. The gameplay of Smile for me is simple. You walk around in first person view. You look at some people who are all in this kind of facility, and you can present them with items from your inventory. Or if they ask you a question, you can physically shake or like nod or shake your head to answer yes or no to their question. The setting that you're in reminds me of Psychonauts just a little bit. You wake up in this facility in which everyone is notably unhappy. But after talking to your first person, you make them happy. Like you do some things for them, you answer their questions, and they are now happy. And they say to you, you've got a knack for this. You should go talk to everyone else. See if you can make everyone else in this facility happy. And there's about 20, I think there's 22 or 23 different NPCs to kind of do that with. And each individual has their own set of like a puzzle or a challenge or a problem that they have that kind of requires you to think outside the box. Maybe you have to find a specific item or use an item sort of in the right place at the right time. The game has an in-game sort of clock that runs from morning until night, which means every time you hit nighttime, you need to go to bed. The game visually looks very childish. The characters that you're looking at all look like they're sort of cut out bits of paper. Their bright colors and 2D sprites kind of give the game a very art book sort of look. But the story and presentation has undertones of horror and oppression, as every night the leader of this facility, Dr. Habit, reminds you that it is not time to smile yet until he is ready for the big event. The walls that you walk past are littered with nonsense advice on how to best achieve happiness and confidence. Cameras watch your every move. Your bed talks to you and invites you to sleep when it gets late. The characters you interact with all seem blissfully unaware that there is something potentially malicious occurring around them. And every night when you go to sleep, a live recorded puppet will play and talk to you in the night. And this puppet represents Dr. Habit sending you messages as he reminds you what it means to be in his facility and that everything you are doing is undermining him and you need to stop. The 20 plus characters in the game are already fun to talk to. They have wonderful art. Like cute writing behind them that kind of makes, like, it's really easy to kind of find a favorite character within the game because they're also vastly different and interesting. You've got a man who needs help opening his jar of pickles so he can pour them on himself so he can smell like pickles because he needs to smell like pickles. A bartender who creates a meal out of non-food items and then, once completed, shouts at you to slap that meat, which you can't do until you've unlocked the boxing glove. And you have a bouncer who, when you free him from his role, he just wants to win a cuddly bear at the carnival nearby, but he'll never admit it. The story in the game is fairly simple. But it's the little character interactions that kind of make the game really enjoyable to play. Performing optional tasks will net you an alternative good ending, which is a little bit Undertale-esque, I think. And the game can be completed quite quickly in about 4 to 5 hours. Unless you are like me and you maybe had to just Google the odd thing here and there, because there were just some bits where my brain was not firing at like the right rate. But ultimately it was a surprisingly fun game given that I went in with zero expectations. That's it. That's my review of Smile for me. Jamie, do you want to smile?
Yeah, I like the sound of it. I like quirky puzzle games. I like sort of story driven puzzle quirky games. In terms of like the puzzle games we really love, right? Things like Obra Dinn and Outer Wilds and stuff. The construction of the puzzle, how do you feel it compares to them? Because you're having to Google stuff. Like,
I mean,
feels like stuff might not be as intuitive as some of the things we really have come to love.
When I had to Google something, there was one occasion where I had Mary with me and I said, Mary, I can't fucking figure it out. Google it and give me a hint, right? So Mary looked it up. And all it was is that I was given some very obvious language, some language that was very well emphasized, and I just overlooked it. Like, I just didn't even occur to me that that was a real important clue. Right. And I was also not comparing the language I was that was being given to me to the environment that I was in. So that was just me having a brain fart.
Right.
How does it compare to those two games as a puzzle game? It doesn't. But that's because we are talking about titans of puzzle games.
Yeah.
This is a point-and-click adventure. That's what this is at its heart.
You would put it more closer to things like, again, putting it up against Titans, but Monkey Island and Grim Fandango and those kind of things.
Yeah, it is more of that than it is anything else. Okay. But... yeah, it's almost like this is a game that I would quite happily present to somebody who didn't know what to expect from point and click, like a point and click puzzle game. Mm. Now keep in mind, it's first person. You're running around in first person doing all the puzzles, so it's not point and click in that sense. But right. if someone was looking for quite an accessible puzzle game with like a bit of a challenge, but also just something that was kind of smooth and relaxing and easy, but with a little bit more under the surface than just that, this is a really good game for that. I think there is more here than you expect there to be upon your first playing of it. And when I got to that ending, I was like, yes, that was the ending to this game, and it was good. And as Mary really wants me to point out in chat, I think the mechanic where you are answering people's questions by physically nodding and shaking your head, because that's a physical input with your mouse, right? That's you lifting the mouse up and down and turning the mouse left and right. It really helps you embody this idea that you are a child who has entered this facility, who has nothing but goodwill. And so you have all of these adults and other children, people, and asking you things. And all you can do is simply nod, shake, or hand item. And I think it's that childlike simplicity in how you interact with this world that lets you kind of like, it kind of melts your heart a bit. Like, you feel like you're just being a helpful child. And yes, the game has a really quite weirdly dark undertone to it that, like, I won't say why, but like, it's there. It really is there. There's this element of horror and fear and that something is oppressive nearby. And I think when you accept that your character is perhaps a child, like an innocent 5-year-old girl or something, it adds that weight to your character, right? Because you don't have the ability to fight off the dangers. You don't have the ability, you don't have a health bar or anything. You just have the kind of like looming presence that something might go wrong for you if you don't succeed. Yeah. Or rather, actually, things will go wrong for you if you continue to succeed, which I think is clever in something that I expected not very much from. I think that was far more than I had bargained for.
It sounds really good. It sounds really nice. Like, I quite like the idea of just a short story puzzle game that you can just sink your teeth into for a bit, have an afternoon of it, and then be done with it.
Yeah.
And like you're saying about playing it with Mary, like, those kind of games are quite nice to play with someone else. Games that don't necessarily offer a direct, intense mechanical threat, but a story-based threat or sort of puzzle esque threat kind of thing, right? Like the other person sat with you is not feeling like they're missing out because they haven't got their hands on the keyboard kind of thing.
Yeah, no, I think it was such a wonderful experience, given that it was just like, oh fuck, it's 10 o'clock on a Saturday, what are we gonna do? Play. And then we just came out early afternoon and just were kind of like, oh, that was really nice. That was actually a really nice thing that we just stumbled across. I think on that merit alone, I have only good thoughts for this game.
I think that's the interesting thing with Humble Monthly, and we'll finish this review up in a moment, but I think that's the interesting thing about the Humble Choice thing is that they sell it on the headliners, but there's always a lot of other stuff in there, and you kind of look at it and you go, well, I don't know this game and I can't really tell what that is, and my time is precious, so I'm not necessarily going to give it a go. But I imagine there's a lot of good games out there like that. Like I imagine I own most of them on my Steam account already. A lot of those like hidden gems that you can.
Exactly. And I think after this experience, I am going to be more open-minded about the games I'm receiving through Humble Choice. Yeah. Because generally I look at the first two games, those are the money games. Mm. And then I disregard everything else unless I've already heard of it. So like had a really positive experience from this.
Oh, cool. All right. Well, if you were to sum it up in a sentence before we move on to the break, how would you sum it up?
I'd call it like a charming brain tickler.
Nice. Nice. All right. You put in other Carto.
Yes. Quick little shout out to Carto. It was recommended by Game Makers Toolkit, which is a YouTube channel that I have nothing but a huge amount of respect for. Carto is a cute little indie game. It was on the Xbox Game Pass, in which you play a child who lands on an island separated from your grandmother, and your main tool of interacting with the world is by opening your map. And the map is empty except for the square that you are standing on. But then you can find other parts of the map. And what you do is you then pick up that square of the new map you found, and you place it like a Carcassonne tile. So grass has to meet grass, road must meet road, water must meet water. But because you control the map, you can pull and rip and move parts of the map around to meet your specific requirements.
Oh, that sounds so good.
So you meet someone who's standing by a river, and he goes, oh yeah, my house is east of the grasslands of that house to the south. So now what you do is you find some grasslands you're not using, you put it east of the house that you've just visited, and suddenly a house appears. That's his house. You found it.
Oh, that sounds so good.
Yes, 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 yes. I can't review it in full because like time, and I haven't played it in full. But really, play 2 hours of it on stream. I'm going to stream some more of it this week, maybe tomorrow or Thursday. It's cute. It's funny. There's some really nice writing in it, but that mechanic is gold.
Okay, I'm in. I'm downloading that. Oh, that sounds cool. So good. And I'll talk about Telos Principle probably next month because I'm really, really massively enjoying it. But I need to know more about that game before I talk about it. I feel like I'm still in the sort of early beginning part of it despite having put hours into it. All right, we're gonna go into a break, and when we come back there'll be movies, loads of movies we chose, movies we didn't choose. Come back in. Hello and welcome back. It's movie time. Everybody likes movies, don't they? And this month I'm reviewing a movie. That's right, me, James the Bunyan Man Willis, and I am reviewing a little movie called Game Night. So you may have heard about this movie. It was a few years ago now. 2018 it was. The heady days of 2018. Oh, do you remember? Oh, what wonderful days those were. Game Night is a comedy action film about a murder mystery night gone very, very wrong. The premise is that a group of friends have a regular weekly game night. Hence the title, eh? And one week, Max, who's played by Jason Bateman, his richer, funnier, more popular brother turns up to join them. And the following week, he invites all of them to his pad for a game night like no other. They're going to have a murder mystery run by a company that specializes in like super over-the-top events. And one of them will actually be kidnapped. The twist is that one of them really does get kidnapped, not by this company, just by kidnappers, you know. The film as a premise basically heavily parodies like action and heist movies, and it does a pretty good job of it, really. I'd say scenes like extremely confidently holding up gangsters with an actual gun because you think it's all fake, or using a WikiHow to learn how to remove a bullet from your husband's arm, are big and funny. And the relationships between other characters are really relatable, which I think is the sort of core as to why this film is quite likeable. Everyone in it is pretty solid acting wise, especially Bateman and Rachel McAdams, who play the main couple, but also Jesse Plemons, who plays their incredibly clingy neighbor, and he is so good. He's in it the least, which is usually what the best characters in comedies are, and he just has this amazing sort of like manner about him, which plays as both creepy and needy and also somewhat sort of competent at the same time. Where I'd say the film is let down is its coherency of plot. As the movie goes on, the twists get more and more numerous and over the top, until before long it's really hard to think back and work out if this movie actually makes any sense. But while maybe that is a failure of storytelling, and I would mark a movie down for that in general, it doesn't make this movie any less entertaining. And arguably, the quality of the comedy and the parody helps to cover that feeling of being lost. Major plot moments at the end feel earned, not because they make story sense, but because they are a satisfying comic conclusion to a barrage of both overblown and inherently relatable moments. You probably can't relate to pulling a bullet from your partner's arm, but you can relate to the fact that should you be forced to, you'd probably react like them. Despite the subject matter, it's actually a fairly light comedy. There's some gruesome, bloody moments that may put off younger viewers, but really, for a film about kidnapping, it actually rarely gets very dark, as long as you don't really think too hard about the implications of any of the plot points. But, you know, I would actually, generally, despite the fact that this was not a film I chose to watch, and initially when I saw it advertised, thought, well, that's just going to be another sort of meh, cash grab kind of comedy, I'd actually genuinely recommend this. If you want like a fun sort of adventurous comedy that has a bit of a kick to it, as opposed to a lot of sitcoms a lot of the sitcoms we've watched on the randomizer, they feel like they move at a glacial speed and they're all about like the comedy in love and kind of things. This isn't that. This is the comedy in well-built relationships, but also normal people put in intensely extreme situations and just stepping up to the plate, basically. I would absolutely recommend it. Have you watched this movie at all, Jonas?
I don't, but I'm curious, how would I watch it if I wanted to?
It was on Netflix. It was just recommend. Yeah. Basically, on the weekend, I said, I've got to watch a film. And Laura said, well, I want to watch Game Night. And I said, well, you're the boss, Captain. And so we sat and we watched Game Night. And yeah, you can catch it on there.
Cool. Okay. Well, yeah, the rating on IMDb is the nicest possible rating, with a 6.9. Generous ratings on Rotten Tomatoes.
It definitely helped that I went in with no expectations at all.
Yeah.
Like, I saw those reviews, I saw those ratings, and I saw people say, like, you know, oh, the plot's a bit meandering and it's not that great. So I went in thinking, I should go get through this. Then I've watched a film and, you know, it's nice spending time with Laura, even if it's not that great a film. And I came out of it thinking, you know, I really genuinely enjoyed that. I genuinely enjoyed the time I spent with that.
I think, yeah, like the idea, like a film around a murder mystery, as someone who is adjacent to a lot of performance, like performance art and interactive entertainment, to someone who, as someone who, like, not only do I really like escape rooms and murder mysteries from a performance side, but I genuinely know people who would cast me as an actor in one of those things and have done similar interactive pieces before. And I fucking loved it. The idea of like an entire action kind of drama being based around one of those going horribly wrong, completely up my street. Not to mention, you mentioned Jesse Plemons, Gary, the clingy neighbor, being the best character. That's Todd from Breaking Bad.
Yeah,
and like I really want to see him.
The creepy Star Trek guy in the Star Trek captain. Black Mirror episode. Yeah,
and I see it's got Dexter in it as well. Like,
yes, it does. Yeah, although that's more of I was quite I think his character is a bit meh, but I think the most exciting thing was being like, oh, Dex is in this film. Like, okay, yeah. Him.
Okay, well, in that case, I've already had that experience, haven't I?
Yeah. I think the thing with the murder mystery thing, I think, is really good about it. And unfortunately, that whole murder mystery thing is basically just the first third of the movie. And then the rest of it is like, and here's another twist, and here's another twist, and then we ramp it up again. And those are fun, but really the bit that you go into it for, the bit that's quite exciting, or not exciting, but the sort of tagline of a game night gone wrong kind of thing, is the first third of the movie. And I think that's done exceptionally well. Like the way that the characters react in that sort of humorously relatable way, in that basically the setup of the scene is that the guy from the murder mystery place comes in, starts giving his sort of speech to them, saying that there's a criminal on the loose going kidnapping, and they're all going, oh yeah, oh this is really good, oh it's really professional, oh you, it's kind of weird that you did that, in that way that like murder mysteries have to make certain leaps of logic to make the thing work, and they're pointing that out as you would in a real life thing. And then the two kidnappers, real kidnappers, come in and beat the shit out of this guy. And then they're all sat there going, this is so realistic. Oh, look at that. Oh, look, he's got a fake gun. Oh, that's so realistic. So that's amazing. Wow. And then the guy they kidnapped gets dragged out of the room. And the guy from the murder mystery place is just unconscious on the floor. And they're all like, oh, he's like a method actor. Oh, it's amazing.
So look good, at
him.
Yeah.
One of them keeps like kicking him in the side, going, get up, man. Get up, man. He's just like laying there on the ground.
That's, yeah, okay. And like to see that itself, I would happily watch the film up until that moment.
Yeah.
Get there. And then I think I would happily make, like, that's a point where I would like self go, now, do I commit?
I would argue that the film by that point has earned enough goodwill that you would want to keep going.
Hope. And because
the main couple in it, Jason Bateman and Rachel McAdams characters, they introduce them in the most endearing way, which is that they have this montage of the two of them being at rival pub quiz teams, and they're like the only competitive people on their team, and everyone else on their team is just hating this experience. And then they meet each other because of that, and then it just goes through their whole lives being incredibly competitive but also very loving. And by the time you get to the point where the movie actually begins and they're about to have their game night, you know exactly who they are and the kind of people they are, and you root for them, but you also know that they are the kind of people who have to win. And there are all these moments where they're put into situations where there is just this intense unearned confidence, and or like they're put in a situation where they have to do something. Again, I talked about it before, but I'll talk about it again. There's a scene where one of them gets shot and the other one has to remove the bullet. And so what they do is they Google it. They Google how to remove a bullet from an arm. And there's this scene where one of them's got the phone and she's trying to remove the bullet from the other guy's arm. And it plays out exactly like you'd imagine you would probably go through that situation, right?
Right.
With less screaming. Significantly more amiable, but the sort of general idea of, oh, that's a really funny version of how I would, how people would react in this scene, these two people. With it. And then towards the end, it sort of goes kind of delightfully off the rails, right? There's a lot of these moments where characters do things that only happen in action movies, but while they're doing it, they are basically going, I can't believe I'm doing the thing from the action movie. Or they try and do a thing from an action movie, and then in real life, it doesn't actually work the way that that they imagined it, and the humor is in them just sort of going, oh yeah, that's a movie thing, isn't it?
Cool.
Yeah, it does a lot of playing with expectations, which I think gives those big moments. But I think also everyone in it is so nice and relatable, and like diverse and different enough, but also on a base level like relatable people that you root for everyone in it. Apart from obviously the villains, but even the villains, I mean, aren't that bad. I think that you encounter one at the end who's basically through and through awful, but apart from that, generally. You know, they're basically props throughout the thing. Do you think you'll give it a go?
In the long term, yes. In the short term, I don't know. I've watched a few films this month, which I'll sort of get to a bit later, and a few of them have just been something in the background while I'm doing a lot of my, because I've been working so much overtime, I sometimes just put on something so that there's just noise while I'm working. And I'm sort of drawn between, do I just put this on so that I can say I've watched it, or do I really want to watch it? In which case, where do I slot that into my busy, busy lifestyle?
Yeah, I would argue that this isn't really a background comedy. I think that it could be, and I think you'd still get fun out of it. But I think that some of the moments in it, some of the twists, they feel earned, not necessarily through the plot. Like I said in the earlier part, like I don't necessarily think the plot is totally coherent. There were moments where something happened and I went, I don't know if that makes sense, because I can't really remember if it does. But they felt earned through the characters, that when someone did something, it was so stupid and it was so much of a stupid twist, but you sort of went, yeah, that's quite funny, especially for this character who's earned this, who's climbed to that point throughout this movie. And I think that you could watch it in the background and still enjoy the set pieces. But I think that if you wanted to enjoy those earned moments, you'd have to sit with it. You'd have to know who the characters are.
Okay. Well, yeah, like it sounds like a film I do want to watch. And I don't see myself putting it off for that long. But also, I'm notoriously bad at getting around to doing the things I want to do.
All right. Well, I will sum it up in a sentence. A genuinely delightful action heist movie parody that I would recommend. All right. We're going to move on to Jonas's movie of the month. Jonas, what are you reviewing for this month?
I'm reviewing Sorry to Bother You. Jamie, it's another film from 2018. How
vintage year.
Wacky is that? What can I say? It really was the year that movies came out in. And there's actually another similarity to your film that I'll get to in a little bit. Sorry to Bother You is a 2018 film about a black man called Cassius Green who works at a call center and ends up using his white voice to succeed. Or at least that's what I thought the film was about. You see, Cassius Green, played by Lakeith Stanfield, starts the film as an unemployed man in Oakland, living in his uncle's garage with his girlfriend Detroit, played by Tessa Thompson. In desperate need of money, he kind of scrounges about and finds himself working in a call center. And from there, he does whatever it takes to make sure that he is successful within his career. Now, going into the film, what I've said above is pretty much everything I knew about the film. And it turns out that only about 25, maybe one third of the movie, just like with Game Night being only about that murder mystery for the first third, Sorry to Bother You being about a black man who works in a call center using his white voice is only about one third of this film. As time goes on, we realize that this premise is only a very small layer of what it has to offer. As the film kind of unfurls itself, the world building starts to present to us like little random themes. We start to see kind of like adverts in the world. We start to see work culture. We start to see kind of like product placement in the world of Sorry to Bother You. That indicates that it is in fact maybe, perhaps, just maybe, not the world that you and I are familiar with. There are aspects of the story, its world, and its characters that are exaggerated in wildly different ways to facilitate this kind of like experience that they end up kind of funneling you down. Things are just so wildly out of place that like once you see them, you know you're not watching something honest. You know you're not watching something serious. Like Terry Crews pulling out, I put small statue in my notes, but it really is quite sizable. Pulling out a sizable statue of Jesus nailed to the cross and then opening the head up to pull out a lighter to use the lighter to light his own cigarette and then putting it back. like Detroit in every scene wearing these massive earrings that spell out various phrases and cusses. And a character will always comment on the earrings. They'll be like, huh, nice earrings, Detroit. Only for the next scene for her to be wearing even larger earrings with like more obscene language. And every single time the camera insists on zooming in so you can really look at those earrings. At certain points, you're really going to start questioning, is this a film set in the real world? Now, the plot, unfortunately, is really hard to talk about. To reveal that there's more than that initial premise, I already feel like that's a lot more information than the film intended for you to go in with. Like, it's advertised about this... It's advertised as this up-and-coming story about a man who works at a call center using his white voice. And it, I don't think the trailer wants you to know that there's more. But fuck me, can I not talk about this film with at least putting a spotlight on that, okay? It, just believe me when I say that it really goes places, but it also takes its time getting there. Slowly adding to the characters and to the world as it escalates into its own batshit bizarre finale. Initially, I expected to compare this film to Black Klansman, but having seen the film, I think there's actually very little that tie the two together, except for the theme of like a black man doing a white man's job. And even then, that link is just extremely tenuous as the film like kind of shows its full hand. There are two characters who are black people who have white voices. The white voices of those characters are played by David Cross for one character and Patton Oswalt for the other. The two characters being respectively Cassius Green and Mr. Redacted, respectively. And like one thing I really loved about the film is just how excellently their voices contrasted their respective characters' real voices. I think that does like a really good job in like hamming up the comedy that extra bit more. But ultimately, this was a film that just, I went in thinking I was going to be watching kind of like just another comedy. And by the end of it, all I had to say was what a fucking wild ride this movie was. Just in a way that I could not foresee and in a way that I cannot explain. It's another film on Netflix. And I think if you're willing, like if you're up for just something that's going to surprise you, this film will do that with no questions asked. And it's enjoyable. I think it's a good film. But that's, yeah, I think that's as much as I can really say about it. Jamie, have you seen Sorry to Bother You?
No, but I am so into this. This sounds right up my alley. This sounds everything I like in films. I like weird, I like kind of social commentary, but like they don't have to be like all into that. And oh, this sounds really good.
So there's like, there is a lot of social commentary in this. Like, basically, where Cassius Green values success and money, his girlfriend Detroit is like an arty activist. And that, you know, they then find themselves at different ends of the spectrum because of that divide. Right. And the story has that undertone of like, you know, success versus, you know, your responsibility to mankind and moral obligations to do the right thing. But again, not something that I think I can really put into context, because it is not knowing where this film is going that just makes it such a fucking delight to be there when it happens. And this is a film that when I watched it, I scrambled to find other people watching it. Because I just needed them to confirm to me that what I had seen was fucking wild. I got that.
It's that Parasite feeling of like there is a big change in this movie that you can't talk about without ruining the movie. And a big part of why that movie feels that way is is that moment, right? I mean, you know the moment I'm talking about, right? Like, a big part of the reason that everyone comes out of that film going, oh my God, that was such a great film. Obviously, it's a masterpiece all the way around, but is the change in that film, the way things change throughout the film. And that's such an appealing thing, especially to experience not knowing. I mean, you were saying you didn't really know anything about this movie, so you had no inkling that there was anything else to it at all then?
No, I genuinely thought this was going to be a comedy film about just a black man in a call center who uses his white voice to get sales or to be successful. Mm. And yes, that happens. And yes, it is an important part of driving the entire like narrative and plot point. But fuck me, is that not where the film ends up? The ending of the film, like, you know, where the film ends up, that does not matter. The fact that he has a white voice doesn't mean shit compared to the weird stuff at the end of the film. And I think, like, I will just never forget some of the stuff that I saw in that film. It's so weird, and it happens so fast. I think that's actually it. Like, I'm thinking about the scene where the penny drops. Fast.
I'm going to have to watch this film, and I think everyone at home is going to have to watch this film as well, because it sounds yes. fucking great. Yeah. I'm in. I'm sold. Don't say another word, because you're going to inadvertently spoil it, and then you're going to feel horrible for ruining it for me. All right, if you were to sum it up in a sentence before we move on, how would you sum it up, my friend?
A wild ride beyond description.
Nice, nice. All right, so you've added a couple of extra movies into our other section. Do you want to talk us through Wolf Walkers?
Yeah, so I've watched so many films this month, or at least three, that I want to talk about them. Wolf Walker. So Wolf Walkers is a film that Mary and I watched. Mary works in animation and was aware of this film from the Manchester Animation Festival, or Manchester, I think it's Manchester Animation Festival. I should have looked this up before I said anything. Anyways, Wolf Walkers, it was this delightfully like cute, well constructed, just like, I don't know. This is a film that I think should absolutely be winning awards and blowing people away everywhere. It's just a film about a girl who, in a world where like, animation festival, yes, okay. In a world in which sort of like old England, like old Dark Ages sort of thing in Ireland, that's it, it's in Ireland. A old town needs to chop down the woods nearby, but the woods nearby are filled with wolves, and the wolves are led by these wolf walkers, which are like people that transform into wolves, but not like werewolves. They're like slightly more magical, and like I think there's like quite a lot of Irish folklore kind of behind them. And it's just a story about how this girl meets another girl who is a wolf walker, and together they become friends. But oh no, her dad is a wolf hunter, and oh, where, how's that going to end up? And it's something that feels akin, if anything, it feels like what Disney has left behind. This classic kind of story of like coming of age and family drama in which a daughter is completely on the other end of the spectrum as to what her like dad wants for her, and is trying to find a way to like declare that independence and to find, you know, to find her own place in this world that doesn't seem to match up with what she wants. It was really beautiful. It was really artistic. The music was just gorgeous from start to finish, and it ended up being a very heartfelt story, and I'm glad it was presented to me. I recommend it thoroughly. And I watched The other film I watched was Mortal Engines. I used to read the Mortal Engines books. I don't remember how many of them I read. I don't know if I ever finished the series. And I don't remember many of the details. But Mortal Engines was turned into a film recently. And like with Artemis Fowl, there's this sense of nostalgia that's like, oh man, a book I used to read is now a film. Let's watch the film to see how it holds up. Mortal Engines holds up slightly better than Artemis Fowl. There are elements that are slightly like weaker that I just the story wasn't anything grand. I didn't have like any emotional connection to any of the characters I was watching. It felt very template, the kind of Hollywood production of it all. But ultimately, it was really cool to see a lot of those visuals brought to life, because Mortal Engines is about mechanical cities wandering the wastelands of like a near post-apocalyptic world, in which there are no cities, there are no towns that are sat down on the earth. There are now just these hulking mechanical cities that run around and essentially eat each other for parts and fuel and stuff. It was a decent watch to put on in the background while I worked. I don't think it's a waste of anyone's time. But again, it's one of those films where it's like, does it live up to the books? No, it doesn't. But it was an all right film nonetheless.
Cool. Yeah, that's one of those films. I haven't read the book, but I remember seeing the trailer and thinking, that looks pretty rad. Cities eating other cities. And then I never watched it. Never got around to it. But yeah, maybe yep. I will. All right, we'll move on to our final section of the day of the podcast. It's everybody's favorite section of the podcast. That's why we leave it right to the end. So you have to stick here throughout the whole thing to hear it. This is the random Netflix movie section. And last month, we picked a movie called Love the Coopers, or Christmas with the Coopers, depending on what thing you read of it. This is a Christmas movie. I mean, that's basically all you need. It's a Christmas movie. It's a movie about a bunch of people trying to meet up for Christmas and then meeting up for Christmas. And then they go to a hospital and there's a dog. Jonas, what did you feel about the movie?
Genuinely, that it was trying to do too much at once.
Okay.
I dislike this film a lot for its... It has this kind of storytelling style, right, where it establishes eight different groups of characters, and they are all somehow interlinked, but you don't know that at the beginning. You just know that some of them are related, right? And then what it does is you watch the film hard cut, and I say hard cut because it doesn't feel good to transition from these scenes. You watch this film hard cut from one group as you experience their little like intro dilemma, and then you watch eight different intro dilemmas, and then you watch eight different like the dilemma exploding or being resolved, and then you watch eight different the characters making up or realizing something about themselves and going through a phase of self-betterment. Then you watch all eight stories come crashing into one house as they all have Christmas together. Everyone's internal conflicts, problems, and previous like established character traits all then clash with each other. It's chaotic, but in the end it's Christmas, so they love each other. Who cares?
Yeah, so Laura put it best, I think, and she messaged me before we started this to say that I needed to tell the stream. Let me see if I can find the exact words.
Bated breath. Drum roll, ladies and gentlemen.
I said, she said, I wish it to be known that in that section that it was maybe the worst film I've ever watched to the end, including that shit Star Wars film. So that's Laura's review of this film. okay. But she also said, in a slightly more nuanced way, that it felt like someone had seen Love Actually and was trying to make that movie.
Yes.
Right? That they had seen this idea of these disparate people who aren't really connected, and then they start to come together through various different connections, and you start to realize that there's this whole human condition and life's great tapestry thing. But they'd seen it and they went, I can do that. And then they started, and then they went, I don't really know how I tie this together. I think that like the big thing for me was that the moment that they get into the house, right, it just becomes a Christmas movie regardless of everything that happened before it. And in fact, you could probably start the movie from the moment they arrive in the house and not have any of the stuff before that, and it would work. It would still be a movie, because everyone at every moment explains everything about themselves. When there's a couple in it who they meet at an airport, and the woman is a hardcore atheist who doesn't care about anyone, and the man is a down home Christian who's off to war and just got stuck in the airport on the way. And despite the fact that all of their dialogue is fucking horrible and infuriating, the setup is that she needs to bring home a man to show that she's like, she's not single and alone, and so she brings him back. But the moment they arrive, they set up scenes that are like, this is the dynamic of this couple, or every moment that they're in a scene together, like, this is the dynamic, that they're not really, that they're chalk and cheese, that they don't get along kind of thing. It's like, there's no sense of anyone's been paying attention to this movie for longer than 5 minutes. Every time any character's on screen, they have to restate why they are who they are and what they're doing. And
yeah, and like, I can say the same thing about Charlotte and Sam, played by Diane Keaton and John Goodman, who are essentially the mum and dad, right, of this entire family. And their entire thing is that they haven't been happily married now for 30 years, ever since they didn't go on that trip to Africa or something. And John Goodman is adamant that this trip has to happen to save their marriage. And like, I don't even remember where that conflict ended, but all I know is that it wasted my time because they kept coming back to it, and they kept coming back to it and making no meaningful progress within their characters and their stance and what this meant within like the bounds of their relationship. And the film kept showing me examples of how one person was trying to save the relationship, but the other person didn't respond to it, but showing me 5 examples of the same argument / difficulty in communication in a couple doesn't equal meaningful movement in like their character progressions or anything like that. And the problem is you can show me those 5 examples, great, fine, I now have a lot of spectrum for these characters, but what you're doing is you're showing me these 5 examples in amongst 8 different storylines, which means no single one of them has the time to sit with me and for me to give a shit about the characters.
But the other thing is exactly that, on top of every time they go back to a scene, they have to explain who these people are again. So every time they go back, they go, here's an example of one of us trying. Oh, by the way, we're having trouble with our relationship.
Yep.
And then here's an example. Oh, by the way, we're having trouble with our relationship. It was the Africa trip. The Africa trip.
I don't even remember. Egg Helms was in this. And like, I don't even remember what his thing is. I think it's like, oh, he's lying that he lost his job or something.
I think he was my favorite character in it. Because his thing is that he had a divorce. And he's just sort of trying to hold it together. And like, not give across that he's sort of falling apart. And like, so just to give an impression to his kids and to his ex-wife and to his family and everything that he's still a capable dad to his child. And he barely appears in it, really. And when he does, he's kind of muted and normal. He's like the most normal of all the characters, but he does have one scene which was fucking great, which is probably the only really funny scene in the show, is him going for a job interview and him being like really, really overly enthusiastic about it, being like these are my qualifications, this is why I'm perfect for the job, and really going into it. And then the guy being like, I think you're way overqualified for this job, man, it's just like a cashier job, man.
Yeah,
like,
we I'm don't not need getting that the job because of it. Yeah,
and just that idea of like, you really need this man, you really need this man. And I like, it's like, oh, okay, I kind of get that. I'd like that movie. I want a movie about that man and not about all of his asshole family members. But like Laura mentions, and I think she's right, one of the reasons that Game Night works so well and this movie doesn't is that it doesn't treat it takes a very traditional view of men and women throughout the whole thing, and that like people aren't seen as like anyone who strays from a normal gender role is painted by the movie as weird, right? Like the atheist harsh woman, she's painted as an outlier and an outcast because she's sort of quite feminist, and actually the sort of kind, soft-hearted American, all-American Christian soldier is painted as quite a down-to-earth guy. And it has no love for anyone outside of the boundaries of a normal heteronormative relationship, which in Game Night, yeah, they're all heteronormative relationships, but at least everyone feels like a real person, right? Like the women get to be women and don't, or like get to be people, get and don't constantly have the movie being like, but she was wrong to be so shouty and angry, or it wasn't ladylike of her to be an atheist, so she bucked up her ideas by the end of the movie.
Yeah, and another thing that's just coming to me as well is one of the other storylines, which is like about an old man who goes to a diner all the time to see a young lady, and the young lady is particularly kind to him or whatever and chatty, but then they get into an argument because it's her last day, and yeah, she doesn't tell him, and just some bullshit.
Do you remember why she's moving?
No,
because it's the dumbest thing, right? So she says, right, I'm moving because I'm gonna go follow my dreams. Now, do you want to guess what her dream is?
No.
Bear in mind, at the moment she is a waitress in a cafe, in a diner.
Her dream was that at one point
on a trip, she passes by a cafe in the middle of nowhere, a diner in the middle of nowhere, and she wants to go work in that diner. And so that's what she's doing. She's giving it all up and she's going to work at a different diner somewhere else.
Oh my God, is that really
that's what she's doing, yeah. That's it.
Oh
she's,
my God.
She's going to be a waitress somewhere else.
Yeah, shame. Real shame.
Yeah, yeah. It's fucking wild, right? And, like, that again, there are so many cinema sins in this film, but that, again, is another one, right? Because that one, towards the end of the film, right, the whole arc between those two is the sort of, like, she's got no one in her life. She's kind of a bit of an outcast. And the grandfather is sort of losing touch with his kids and sort of seeing her as a surrogate child to replace his kids who aren't really talking to him very much anymore. And then he brings her to the family meal as sort of recompense for him blowing up in her face for abandoning him too. And then there's this moment in the final scene where everyone starts dancing in the hospital. One of them has a heart attack. Fuck, it doesn't matter. they're dancing in this hospital, and Ed Helms' character asks her for a dance, and there's this moment where it's like, and everyone was coupled up, Ed Helms and the cafe girl were coupled up, and there was this moment where it was like, I knew the movie was going to put them together, but it didn't earn this in any way. It just went, there are two people left over.
Well, doesn't as well. So I remember I remember there being this undertone of like, is this going to try and say to me, hey, Jonas, age is just a number.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
love absolutely blossoms where it will.
So the text is that he is like a kindly older man who's doing a nice thing for her, right? The subtext I think they were intending, or at least they wanted people to think, was she's filling sort of a void that his daughters aren't.
Yeah.
But the subtext that's definitely there,
yeah,
right?
Oh, God.
Death of the Author style, this is the subtext of the movie, is he wants to bang this woman, and the only thing stopping him is he realizes at every step that everyone is just going to look down on him for it. And at the end, he's like, well, I guess my grandson banging her is better. Yeah,
no, because I remember there being this energy, and I don't remember if I imagined it or if the film presented it to me, but basically I have this ghost of a feeling that was her looking at him him looking at her, him being presented to us on camera as a potentially younger man. Like, what if he was just, what if he was 30? What if the old man was 30? This would be perfect. But he's not 30. He's like 90 or 80.
Laura's saying in the chat, they do kiss in the film. She kisses him at one point to be like, oh, you're such a sweet old man. I rest my case,
Your Honor.
It's pretty rough. Well, not a recommend from us, I'd say. They're definitely better. If you want a movie like this but good, watch Love Actually. Where it's a movie that actually does do what they're trying to do. All right, well, we'll move on. We'll release you from all of this. No, that did happen. That absolutely happened, Laura. Okay, so we're going to move on from this. We're going to move on to the random movie for next month. Woo! And this is the movie we're going to be watching over the Christmas period. Yeah. Our exciting Christmas movie. Okay, everybody. In mere moments, I will be turning on a little randomizer. I'll be whirring up the randomizer, getting the hamsters to run on their wheels. And I am going to want you guys to post something in chat. Jonas is going to give you an 8-number range or thing range, whatever. And I want you to type it in chat. The first one to use the highlight my message feature to send us one of these things back to us gets to pick what movie we're watching. I could have explained that better, but that, everyone knows how it works at this point. You got to use the highlight my things. You can waste me all you like. Look, the Bunyip Bucks are there for a reason, all right? They're not just for toxic wasting me.
Besides, it's not like we're asking you to submit bits or like subscribe to the channel or something. You're getting these Bunyip Bucks for free, all right? I really hate this. I wanted to do something chess themed, but there are not 8 different chess pieces. you know what I mean? I thought that would be really fun. But I can't do that. I guess I'll just have to be boring and go for like a number range.
How many Xboxes were there?
There have not yet been enough Xboxes, unless you maybe include the derivatives.
But how many were there?
Okay, so Xbox 360.
I was going to say PlayStations and then Xboxes, but that's too many. Oh my God,
yeah, that would just be overkill.
Yeah.
No. One second. You've got me on a little... Fill for time.
All right. Well, so while Jonas picks, I was having an idea for, and I haven't actually discussed this with Jonas. I was going to discuss it with Jonas after the podcast, but since Jonas wants me to fill time, I'll just announce it now and then he'll have to do it. I'm thinking that in January, we should do a little award ceremony, like a little award night for the best films, video games, movies, and Netflix randomizers that we saw over the year. So thinking something like, I pick my best out of each category from the things that I reviewed, and Jonas picks his best out of each category for the things he reviews. And then on the show, the two of us sit there and discuss together who we think is the overall winner out of those two runner-ups, I guess, or those two best ofs, which I think might be a little fun thing to do. And we can jazz it up. We can wear suits or something. That'd be good. And then obviously picking the best Netflix randomizer will be the award that I think everyone's waiting for. Have you picked a set of categories, Janice?
Yes, I have. And I pasted them in our docket for us to refer to.
Look at the randomizer. There we go. Okay, cool. Okay.
Yep. Okay. So there are 8 of these. And don't get tripped up. Don't just try and run for the gun when you first hear some of the keywords, because it's not going to be as basic as you think it is. I would like people in chat to give me a home console made by Nintendo. Not a handheld console, a home console made by Nintendo. There are 8 of them, starting with the Color TV game back in 1997, all the way down to the Nintendo Switch in 2017. If I can get the full name, or even just a smart abbreviation,
Squig! You've got to use Highlight My Message. No, you've got to use Highlight My Message.
Wait, Squig redeemed Highlight My Message 1000 Squig Nintendo GameCube.
Oh, it didn't show up as Highlight My Message on mine.
It does on mine, interestingly.
Well, there we go then. Squig has got it. Fucking Twitch, man.
Everyone, put away your bunyip bucks. Squig's done
I don't understand Twitch. It, on mine, it genuinely is just a normal message.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that, Twitch. Thanks, all right. Squig, okay, so Nintendo GameCube. Nintendo GameCube.
That's number 5 in the list.
That will be... okay.
Jamie, I hate it when you do that.
I don't really know what it is. So, okay. Here's what you could have won. I don't need to rig it, man. I could just pick. Okay. What we could have won is we could have had the BFG. We could have had True Romance, which I fucking would have loved. That's a really good film. We could have had Girls with Balls. We could have had David Foster on the record. We could have had Sahara. We could have had Jen Kirkman, Just Keep Living. We could have had Baby Dolls, also known as Gideon Patol. But instead we're watching Sokano.
Sokano.
This biographical drama about Indonesia's first president recounts his nationalist crusade to seize independence from Dutch colonial rule.
Give me a name.
Yeah. Hold on. I'm just going to make sure it is actually on Netflix. Yeah, it is. Okay, so here's the link in the Twitch chat. And I'll post it in Discord for you, Jonas, and I'll post it on the doc. Okay, so it is an Indonesian movie, which means it is not a Bollywood movie. So for those in the audio podcast, we play a little gambling game where you can bet on whether it's a Bollywood movie or not. And I'm afraid it's not a Bollywood movie. So those who picked no, they win their points. All right, well, so what do you think about this then? It's a biographical drama.
Yeah, I guess I'll be open-minded about it, right? Like, I quite like was it football that he played?
The football one, yeah.
I've already forgotten the name and obviously all the details about it.
No, it was hockey. It was hockey.
Yes. Okay, that wasn't bad. That, like, I quite enjoyed that. So I think, like, if done well, it will be enjoyable.
So in the more like this on Netflix, there's Three Heroines, which is about people, female archers in the Olympics. There is Ave Mariam. She's a dutiful servant of the Lord, but can this nun's commitment endure the amorous test of the heart? there's The Dancer, Hunter in the Blue Side of Manchester.
I like that title, Hunter in the Blue Side of Manchester.
Yeah.
You
must have enjoyed it too much if you didn't remember the sport, says Squig in chat. Well, there we go. I think that's going to be it for us today. I'm interested. I'm gonna give it a go. No, that sounds good. 7 out of 10 on IMDb. Fair enough. I've watched worse. So,
have you got anything that you're going to put in the recommend section?
Oh, well, you've forced us into a segment.
Yeah, I've opened the box.
What would I recommend? What have I done lately that isn't anything to do? Oh, well, I might have already recommended this in the past, but I'm going to recommend it again because it just came out. There's a new Till Death Do Us Blart, the Thanksgiving My Brother and Me podcast. And this year they've done a director's commentary. So they just, you're supposed to watch it side by side with the film, and they just talk over the film. And so I may, for the first time ever, actually watch Paul Blart 2. Paul Blart Mall Cop 2. Oh yeah, and Skyfarer. I'll recommend Skyfarer as well. The pen and paper RPG based on Sunless Skies, because we've been playing a shitload of that. And you can see that every other Friday here on twitch.tv/TheBunyipMan. And Jonas, do you have anything else to recommend?
Yeah, like your pause there, I was like, I'll let him finish. I'm going to recommend it's a bit niche. I've had a song stuck in my head for the last few days now, and the song is called We All Lift. And the song was featured in an expansion trailer video for Warframe, in which you just hear this song, and it's like, it's very much like people down in the mines singing together about their experience working and living. We All Lift. And I heard it in a remix, and I got so obsessed and so interested in what the original song was. I've now been listening to that song We All Lift over and over and over again over the last few days. And that comes from someone who is not a Warframe player. I just really like that song. It's a nice little 2.5 minute sort of ditty that feels like it belongs in like a D&D kind of dwarven mining city. It's decent.
Cool. All right. Thank you for watching if you're watching on Twitch at the moment. And thank you for listening if you're listening to the audio version of the podcast. If you're listening to the audio version of the podcast, you can find us on the first Tuesday of every month on twitch.tv/TheBunyipMan, where you can shout at us in chat and you can engage in gambling and you can help us pick the random Netflix movie and more things. Check us out. And if you're watching live on twitch.tv, you can catch this as an audio podcast, slightly edited, although this month's probably heavily edited, down to something nice and portable that you can carry around and listen to while you paint your stairs or rake your garden of those autumnal leaves. You can find us at... Jonas, where can you find the podcast? I mean, you can search The Bunyip Review on anything, but do you remember exactly where it is?
I mean, so the podcast is hosted by Buzzsprout. Thank you, Buzzsprout, for hosting the podcast. You can, of course, find our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Pandora, TuneIn, plus Alexa, Podcast Addict, Podchaser, Pocket Cast, Deezer, Listen Notes, Player FM, Podcast Index, and any other podcast platforming sites that takes its feeds from one of those above, which most take theirs from Apple Podcasts. We're all over the bloody place. You can search our names in Spotify and we come up with our glistening podcast logo. And if that isn't like an incredible way to impress your friends, I don't know what is.
And if you enjoy the podcast, either on Twitch live or in the audio format, reviews on various podcast sites are most appreciated. Absolutely. They really help us grow. They help us find new audience that get to listen to us ramble for 2.5 hours about TV shows we once watched because we had to. Thank you for listening and watching, everybody. What were you going to say, Jonas?
I was just going to say, I dream of a world in which you're sharing a drink with a stranger or a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend, and you just happen to name drop The Bunyip Review, and they look up at you and they go, "You too." That's
one day,
the moment.
Maybe,
that's
maybe
the moment.
Maybe over the month we'll work out a secret handshake you can do, and then you can then you'll know the others. All right, we'll see you later. Goodbye.
Goodbye, everyone. Thanks for listening.